All right. Well, good morning. As Travis said, this morning you are getting three sermons for the price of one. Because we have three distinct things that we do need to talk about this morning, and the first one would be COVID-related. Probably most of you saw the announcement from the CDC this past Thursday, and so we need to talk about that. Secondly, we're going to talk about, or I'm going to give a little bit of a rehash of our missions campaign. We just finished that up last week, and so I want to summarize some things and reemphasize a couple points there. And then we're going to get into our real sermon, our actual passage this morning in Acts 25. We've been teaching through the book of Acts for quite a while. We took a break for our missions campaign. Well, we're going to jump back in there, at least for a few minutes, this morning in Acts chapter 25. So three sermons, but don't worry. I have some incentive to keep it a little shorter. My wife is back in children's ministry this morning. And so, if she has to stall and spend a half hour playing Heads Up 7-Up, I'm going to be in trouble. So, we're going to try to keep it pretty succinct, but we do have three things to share. So let me pray for us, and we'll get into each of those. Well, Lord, we do, in all seriousness, ask you for direction this morning. I think we have some important things to talk about, and we need your guidance in those things. And so I pray that you would direct our hearts, you would fill us with the Spirit. Lord, I pray that you would help us to strive for unity, for love. Pray that you would remind us of your presence this morning, and that you would clearly communicate. Dear Lord, I pray that we would have your thoughts, your direction this morning. And so we again surrender the rest of our morning to you and ask for your guidance in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so the first one is about COVID. And this actually may be the longest sermon of the three this morning, because I think it's important that we talk about this. You again probably saw the update from the CDC just a few days ago on Thursday, and this is from the language from their site. And there was an update that fully vaccinated people no longer need to wear a mask or physically distance in any setting, with a few exceptions there. And so that was kind of surprising, actually, and it wasn't expected on my part, but this presents decisions for all of us, of course. And so I think it is necessary to spend a fair amount of time talking about it this morning, and especially because this factors into the unity of the church. And that's a really important thing in God's mind. And of course, the unity of the church has been tested for over a year now, with some casualties. Now we're moving into a new phase where there are different decisions to make regarding masks and regarding vaccinations and that sort of thing, and there are new challenges for the unity of the church, and so we must work to preserve that unity. As it says in Ephesians, to make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. And so that's what we want to try to do. But with this announcement, really the whole country is being moved into a different phase here. And we as a church are as well. And so we wanted to communicate that and what we feel like that means for our Sunday mornings. And basically that does mean that we are going to move to making masks optional. Now, before you tear off your mask and throw it on the floor and stomp on it defiantly, let's talk a little bit. And I would encourage you to continue to wear your masks this morning. You know, we all came in here, probably everybody, expecting a masked crowd here, and so I would just encourage you to keep it on this morning, but starting next week, we are going to make those masks optional. Okay, so let's again talk about it. Obviously, up until this point, we have asked all of you to wear a mask when you come on Sunday morning. And we have tried to comply with what we've been instructed in by the governing authorities. And of course, there's different opinions on whether or not that should be the course to take. And there, obviously, we all know there can be disagreement, but that's the course that we have taken. We've asked people to distance and to wear masks here on Sunday morning. What I want to do for the next few minutes is take us through the factors that have gone into that decision and the factors that are going into this decision now. Okay? So let's think about the criteria that we've tried to use for all these COVID-related decisions, which are not easy decisions. Okay, I'm kind of ready to be done with these decisions myself. But in the honoring of God, we of course have had to make decisions, and we've had to ask ourselves questions: what is important to consider as we make these decisions? And so I want to give you four questions that we've had to consistently ask. They are these. Number one, what does it mean to be safe? To create an environment, a community here that actually is safe. You know, is this, how deadly of a virus is this, and what would be safe for our community here? Number two, what does it mean to be subject to the government? What does that actually mean? We'll share some verses later, but of course the New Testament does give us that instruction to be subject to the government. Number three, what does it mean to care for the convictions of our brothers and sisters in the church? And I think that's a really, really important one for us, often overlooked. But the Bible is also very strong here that we care for the consciences of one another, and we should do that in lots of different areas. And then fourthly, what does it mean to be the church? What does it mean to continue to operate in the essential functions of the church? Okay, so those are four questions that we have to consistently ask, that we have had to consistently ask the last year. Now, I'm going to try to take us through each of these questions, but in doing so, a couple thoughts to begin with. Number one, this takes a lot of humility. I think we all have to acknowledge that there aren't real clear answers to these questions. There's a lot of gray here. And none of us really know. You know, this is still relatively new. Yes, we've been in this for a little over a year, but we still don't really know. Maybe in 5 years, maybe in 20 years, we're going to look back and say, okay, that was a bad decision, that was a good decision, and we'll know a little bit more, but we don't really know. So I think we have to approach this with a certain degree of humility. Also, I think we have to understand that we have to optimize a little bit here. That we will not be able to answer each one of these questions with every decision in a 100% satisfactory way. There's a little bit of give and take. Sometimes being the church doesn't mean 100% safe. Sometimes being the church means asking people to maintain stricter practices than their convictions would point them towards. Okay, there is a little bit of a balancing act here. And so we have to sort of optimize, and we're not going to hit every one of these 100% perfectly. Okay, but let's take us through them. And I'm going to take us through them, one, how we've operated this last year, and then we're going to go through them very briefly again as we move into this next phase and why we feel like we can, in faith, move into this next phase. So first of all, what does it mean to be safe? And we have to ask, well, what is this COVID thing? How deadly is it? How severe and serious is it? Obviously, there's lots of different opinions about that. And I myself have even gone back and forth. As different information and data has become available, I've kind of gone up and down over the months. But how serious is it, and how does that factor into the decisions we make about masks and meeting and that sort of thing? The thing is, it's really hard to know, as I just said, especially because it's really hard to know what metric to use. You know, what's the right metric to use here? It doesn't seem like a lot of them are all that trustworthy. I mean, we can look at case data, But of course, that depends on people getting tested, and that depends on accurate tests. And I think we all know situations where we say, well, I'm pretty sure that was a false negative, or I'm pretty sure that was a false positive, and so it can be hard to know what to rely upon. The COVID-related death data, also hard to know how reliable it is. You know, we've all heard that. How do you classify a COVID-related death? Just if COVID was involved at all, does that mean it was you know, COVID was the main factor? And so these are hard metrics to use. In my opinion, the one metric that I have felt is pretty clear, is kind of black and white, and gives some picture, is the metric of total deaths in the United States by all causes. Okay, by all causes, and then compare that to what we would expect it to be. Okay, so I'm going to show you some charts. And so here we have a chart, and this is 5 years of data, deaths, number of deaths over the course of a year in the United States. And so by week, every week out of those 52 weeks, there's a certain number of deaths, say between 50,000 and 60,000, that occur in the United States. And you'll see it's pretty consistent. The shape of the curve is very, very consistent. It bumps up just a little bit each year, probably with population growth. Deaths are higher in the winter months, and then they dip down in the summer and then rise again as it gets colder. And so this is the number of deaths in the United States. You'll see a little blip there. The blue 2018 at the very beginning of the year, and really at the very end of 2017, the yellow, you'll see a rise there. That was when we had a really bad flu year. If you remember, 2017-18 was a really bad flu year. There were more deaths in the United States during that time. Well, now let's add 2020 on there. And it's pretty significant. And there were a lot of deaths, more deaths than would have been expected. And you see it's tracking along pretty well for the first 2 to 3 months of the year. And then beginning in late March, it really goes up. And by the end of the year, there were about 450,000 more deaths than would have been expected. And that's about a 16% increase, despite COVID not really being a factor the first couple months of the year, probably the most deadly months, most cold months, and of course, pretty extreme precautions being taken. So I look at that and I say, well, COVID is not nothing. Okay, it's not nothing. Okay, there's something to it. It's more than just a flu. That said, the total death data isn't the only factor we take into account. There are certainly social and economic factors that we take into account, and those can be pretty serious too. But I just share this initially to say, okay, COVID's not nothing, and so it's probably appropriate to consider certain safety precautions. Okay, so as we approach that first question over this last year, we've thought, okay, it's probably appropriate to consider safety precautions. Let's look at question number two. What does it mean to be subject to the government? This is a tricky one. We have all these verses in the New Testament that are pretty strong and pretty clear, saying to be subject to the government, to be submissive to the government. But of course, we also have examples in the New Testament of disobeying the authorities when the authorities pressed beyond their limitations in a pretty extreme way. And so we have those examples as well. And so what do we do with this? Again, clear, strong commands to be subject to the government, and yet knowing that there are some caveats in there. Well, how have we approached that over this past year? Well, we've wrestled. I'll just be honest, we have wrestled, and there's been conversation and prayer and, you know, trying to figure this out. What does this mean for our situation? Where we have landed this past year is to go ahead and comply with what the government has asked us to do. We may have done differently if we were in a different part of the country, honestly. I think there are certain parts of the country where I think we would have very likely acted very differently. However, in our interactions with local authorities here, we have experienced a fair amount of accommodation and a willingness to work with us and work with the church community in this area. And so far, we have felt like it's probably appropriate to comply with what has been asked of us. There could be a time where we change that, definitely. We've considered that, but that's what we have felt thus far. The third question, what does it mean to care for the convictions of our brothers and sisters in the church? And again, I think this is a very important one. I could list many, many passages about this, but in Romans 14 and 1 Corinthians 8, there's again a pretty strong encouragement to not put stumbling blocks in the way of others, to make sure that you do not wound another's conscience. And so we want to take this into account also, recognizing that there are lots of people in our church with special sensitivities to this. That there are some that probably have conditions that make them vulnerable. There are some that work with lots of vulnerable people. There are some who have experienced death of loved ones due to COVID. And of course, each one of those situations creates that special sensitivity. And so when I think about our guidelines, and even when I think about relaxing guidelines, my mind goes to specific people. I say, well, what about him? What about her? And I know this has been very, very heavy for those people. And so that just gives me a pause, and I consider those people whose consciences I want to especially honor. Okay? So there's that consideration. But then the fourth question, what does it mean to be the church? Because as we think through all of these other questions, we also have to say, okay, we are under an obligation to meet together, to love one another, to be the body. We've talked about that through our missions campaign. I could share part of 1 Corinthians 12, which talks about how essential every part of the body is. I'll read it. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. But as it is, God arranged the members of the body, each one of them as he chose. And I think this whole situation over the last year has challenged a lot of us in asking, what is church for and what's my role in the church? Because it's very easy to ask ourselves, to think, I should come to church because it's good for me. But I think a tweak to that is, no, I should come to church because it's good for everybody else, because I am an indispensable part of the body. And God has knit us together, and we have to still operate as the church, as the body. And so we have to take all of these different things into account. And so where we have landed for this past year is we have decided to meet together, of course, on Sunday mornings, and even encourage people to join us on Sunday mornings or in your small group settings, knowing that you are an essential part of the church. But having these guidelines in place for those other reasons that I just described, and to hopefully create a community that honors certain convictions and positions that people are in while still calling people to unite as the church. Okay, but we're in the middle of a transition here as well. Okay, and so let's think now, why are we in this transition, and why do we feel like we can in faith step forward into this new phase? Well, let's go through those questions really quickly again. What does it mean to be safe? Well, I showed this chart earlier showing that COVID is not nothing. Okay, it is pretty significant, and it has killed a lot of people. At the same time, I could add 2021 onto there, and I'll add that really quickly. And it's pretty interesting. It started out in January very, very high again, but of course, over a couple months, it dropped. And the last few weeks of data are not on there because they're incomplete, But the number of total deaths in our country has fallen right into line with what it would be expected to be, maybe even slightly below. It's actually below 2019, 2018. And is this an indication that things are returning to at least a manageable place? And we think they are. And you could, of course, look at other pieces of data, but it seems like it's, you know, we're moving into that place for a lot of reasons. Obviously, vaccines play a part into that, probably different treatments. There are lots of different factors that go into this, but it seems like we're returning to a manageable place. We're also entering into warm summer months. School's not in session. And it seems like we can have a greater confidence that there is a general safety. Number two, what does it mean to be subject to the government? Well, this is kind of being taken off the table. With the recent CDC announcement, of course, that changes things. Now, of course, the CDC does make that announcement for vaccinated people. And so what we're going to do, we have this passport app that we're developing. No, I'm joking. We don't feel like it's our it's our place to ask. And so that puts it on your conscience. And we're leaving it up to you to do what you see fit. Now we're asking you to consider all these questions and then step into a place of faith there. But we're not, since the CDC has come out with this announcement, we feel like that moves us into a place where it is an optional thing. Third question, what does it mean to care for people's convictions and consciences? Well, we are hoping that we can move into a place that does accommodate for those convictions and consciences. Hopefully, there has been a fair amount of time for those that would want to get a vaccination to do so and to have that confidence. Also, we are going to have our gym open and live streaming in there, and the gym, we are going to make a masked zone. Okay, so if you feel more comfortable wearing a mask and being around others who are wearing a mask, definitely the gym is available. And of course, we're moving into warmer months, and there's outdoors available too, before and after church, just for fellowshipping. And so our hope is that we're in a place where we can honor different convictions here, but still make things optional. And then finally, what does it mean to be the church? Well, in this case, I think being the church means still making every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace and striving to love each other well. And our hope is that from, you know, starting next week, there is a special sensitivity, a special effort to love each other, that whoever's in the minority, in whatever setting they're in, they don't have to feel condemnation, and we would all feel freedom. Okay, if you can check through these questions, and your conscience is free, and you feel like in faith you can move towards not wearing a mask, that's fine. If you check these boxes and say, well, you know what, I think I want to come to church, but I still want to wear a mask, that's fantastic too. And so we're hoping that regardless of what things look like from here on out, each one of us would be striving, making every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace. So that's where we're moving. And of course, there may be questions there. Feel free to talk to me or the other pastors. And this is still going to be in process. But starting next Sunday, we would like to make masks optional, but still having the gym open and having people wear masks there. Okay. Whew. We're going to move on to sermon number two. And that is the missions campaign. I just want to give a few minutes, quick recap. And so, as you know, last week we finished up our four-week missions campaign where we were trying to raise money for missions. And just wanted to first, you know, give you the numbers. You may have seen some numbers in an email this past week. But for one, our target was $50,000. We wanted to raise $50,000 for missions. And as of yesterday, we were at $61,500. So yeah. Yeah, so that's a huge encouragement. That's definitely to be celebrated. I believe there were 96 people that made some sort of a financial pledge, and 120-something that, in addition to a financial pledge, made a pledge of service, a non-financial pledge, which is great. That's a doubling the number of those that contributed financially last year to our missions campaign, and that really was what we were after. Okay, we were being kind of tricky here. We were saying it was a financial fundraising campaign, but maybe even more than that, it was an effort to draw people into the heart of the church. Okay, especially after this year, to help people step into that and say, yeah, this is my church, and I'm going to bring myself. I'm going to be that part of the body that God designed me to be, that God arranged for me to be. And we think that's happening. So it's more than money. Again, we could go back to 1 Corinthians 12, which I just read. We are all indispensable parts of the body. And hopefully these last few weeks, we have been reminded of that. As I said, there were many non-financial pledges. It's kind of fun to just glance through those. Our commitment now, our pledge, is to comb through those and do all that we can as church leaders to set you up in a position where you can carry out who you are as a part of the body. Okay, so that's our goal. And that could take some time, and it might be a little clunky and not completely smooth, but we would love to help you walk in those things. And so we're going to really be making efforts to do that over the upcoming weeks. But remember, your contribution is funding these things. There is new gospel ministry that's going to be happening among the younger generation in Severance, Colorado, and internationally all around the world. And we're really excited that these people are being freed up to bring the glory of God's grace to these different needy places. Now, you might ask, well, we raised at least $61,000. What about the extra? Well, for one, we're just going to be able to support our missionaries a little bit more. And that was the intention even before. Supposing that we did exceed our goal, we were going to be able to distribute more to our missionaries, which is a huge blessing. I mean, it's always a burden to raise support for our missionaries, so we'll be able to help them out a little bit more. But also, I think there's the opportunity for this to go to future ministry in Severance or among the younger generation. You know, how we saw this, each of these projects that we're trying to move forward, what we're doing with this money is we are using it to get the ball rolling on these new initiatives. In time, those initiatives are to be supported by the regular tithe of the church. That's why we emphasized the tithe actually a couple weeks ago. But this is kind of this initial get the ball rolling and get things happening and then hopefully fill in time. Well, that initial get the ball rolling probably takes at least a couple of years, say on a church plant. And so if we exceed our goal for the first year, there will probably be plenty of opportunity to use that in years to come, with especially this church plant. And so we're just really excited to have that. And so thank you again for your contribution, whether financial or non-financial. All right. Sermon number 3. Where am I? Okay. All right, so we're going to go through this pretty quickly, again, so I don't get in trouble. Why don't you open up to Acts chapter 25. And I'll give you a page number. If you're using a house Bible, that's going to be on page 934. And let me remind us where we are in the book of Acts. Again, it's been a few weeks since we've been in Acts. But starting in chapter 21 of Acts, Paul returns to Jerusalem and he's arrested. Okay, he's arrested. Acts has 28 chapters, so from that point to the end of the book, Paul is transferred around from person to person, authority to authority, prison to prison, while he's under arrest and in prison. And it's sort of interesting that a full quarter of the book of Acts, this history book of the first 30 years of the early church, is about Paul's, basically his imprisonment. And the different things he says to different people and how he responds to this imprisonment. And so that's what's happening. And in Acts 25, he is before this man named Festus. Previously, Paul had been arrested. He spoke before the Jewish council. He spoke before the crowds of people. Then he spoke before this man named Felix, who was the governor, the procurator of Judea, of that region. He was the Roman official there. And he spoke before Felix, and Felix kept him in jail for a couple years until Felix was succeeded by this man named Festus. And so we're going to pick it up there. I'm going to read some of Acts 25, although I'll paraphrase parts of it. Now, 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem, because they were planning an ambush to kill him on the way. Festus replied that Paul was being kept in Caesarea and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So he said, "Let the men of authority among you go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him." After he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. And the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense." But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, "Do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me?" But Paul said, "I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar." Then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, answered, "To Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go." Then the last half of the chapter is when King Agrippa and his sister Bernice come into the picture. They are visiting Festus, and Festus asks or tells them about Paul's situation. We'll drop down a few verses, and we'll read a little bit of how Festus describes Paul's situation. He says, verse 17, "So when they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who is dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive." And then he explains how he didn't really know what to do with this case. And so then Agrippa wants to hear from him himself, and there's that little transition. And then in chapter 26, we'll see Paul speaking before Agrippa. Okay, so let's first of all get to know some of the players, some of the people that are mentioned in this chapter. We'll start with the Jewish leaders. It says the chief priests and the principal men, they had not waned in their hatred of Paul. Okay, so 2 years after Paul's initial detainment under Felix, they were still determined to kill him. Okay, they hadn't forgotten. Now with a new authority in place, they wanted to renew their case and go after Paul again, and they were even planning an ambush to kill him if he was transferred to Jerusalem. So there are the Jewish leaders there. Then there's Felix. So Felix was mentioned, he was the key figure last chapter, but we'll summarize him again. He's the procurator of Judea from about AD 52 to 60, known for his cunningness, resourcefulness, and brutality. His rule was also characterized by insurrection and instability. That's who Felix was. Next, there's Festus, the key figure of this chapter. He ruled Judea from about 60 to 62 AD, although little is known about his rule and his character, but his office of procurator had a constantly revolving door and was known for corruption. Then we've got Agrippa and Bernice. Marcus Julius Agrippa II was the great-grandson of Herod the Great. He was raised in Rome in the court of Emperor Claudius and was eventually given the territory north of Judea to rule. Bernice was his sister, younger by 1 year, and lived with him after the death of her first husband. And both of them were a little shady as well. And then there's Caesar. He appeals to Caesar. Well, Caesar at this time was Nero, okay? Which is sort of interesting. This is the guy that Paul appeals to. Nero was the Roman emperor from AD 54 to 68. The early years of Nero's reign, while still under the influence of certain advisors, was considered somewhat of a golden age. Prior to the shift in attitude, the final 5 years of his reign, he kind of went crazy. And of course, he becomes very infamous for his persecution of Christians. These are the people that are involved here. And Paul's life is going to, at least from an earthly perspective, be determined by the decisions of these kinds of people. They're not exactly the kind of people that you want your life to be in the hands of. But these were the people, and he knew it. And he walked straight into the teeth of this kind of environment. Going back to Acts 20, before he arrived in Jerusalem, this is what he says. "And now, behold, I am going to Jerusalem, constrained by the Spirit, not knowing what will happen to me there, except that the Holy Spirit testifies to me in every city that imprisonment and afflictions await me." So he knows this is right where he's going. He's going to subject himself to all of these really, really untrustworthy people, and he doesn't know what's going to happen. Okay, he doesn't know what's going to happen. He knows it's going to be hard, but he still goes. He still walks right into it. And this is interesting. I think there's a little bit of parallel here for us, not knowing the future, not knowing exactly what it's going to look like, but wondering if it's going to be hard. You know, I think as Christians, sometimes we can think about the future and feel like things are getting harder, that the society that we're heading into is going to be less and less supportive of our faith. And we don't know exactly how it's going to look. You know, there are different opinions. We can't really predict the future, and we're not sure exactly how it's going to look. Maybe the people in charge are going to be kind of like the Jewish leaders that were really, really hostile towards the faith and wanted to destroy it. Sometimes we could feel like, I think that's where we're heading. It feels really hostile out there, and it's going to get really, really bad for us, and prison might be awaiting us as Christians if we hold on to our faith. Sometimes we think maybe the people in charge, it's going to be more like the Roman leaders who were kind of indifferent to Paul and his message and his faith. They were probably just, they were politicians. They wanted to keep things in relative order and protect their own positions, but they weren't guided by a lot of conviction, I wouldn't say. And sometimes I can wonder, where are we heading? Are we heading to that very, very hostile environment that opposes us very directly? Or are we heading to a more just sort of indifferent, self-indulgent kind of society that doesn't care about our message? Now, I think either one of them is going to be hard. Either one of them is going to be hard. So regardless of what it looks like, it is going to require a remarkable kind of faith. Well, Paul had that kind of faith as he went into this sort of situation, knowing that things were going to be hard and knowing that his life was going to be tossed back and forth by these very untrustworthy people that were in authority, he was still able to walk straight into that. And he was able to communicate, showing this remarkable faith. For one, Paul was able to speak clearly, calmly, and confidently in each setting he found himself in. I think this is one of the remarkable things as we read through all these chapters, is that he spoke with incredible confidence and just very straightforwardly. He didn't get rattled. He wasn't belligerent. He wasn't angry. It didn't seem like he was fearful. He just laid out the truth very plainly. Secondly, Paul was able to shrewdly use the legal resources available to him. This was his appeal to Caesar. You know, Paul wasn't afraid to die, but he didn't just have this death wish either. And he was determined to be used in whatever way he could for as long as he could, and therefore he shrewdly used what was available to him. And there was a likelihood that he was going to be taken back to Jerusalem and then killed. And so he makes this appeal, as a Roman citizen could, to be on trial before Caesar. Even though Caesar was Nero at the time, and it wasn't quite apparent how bad he was going to be, but still, he would be confident that it was going to be much better under Nero. And so he uses what's available to him just very shrewdly. And then thirdly, he adapts the expression of his faith and mission to each new situation. He was given this responsibility to preach the gospel to the masses. He was also compelled to go to Jerusalem, where he knew he would be arrested, and then his situation would be changed because he was going to find himself in prison. He was going to be very limited. His access to people would be very limited. And so he adapted his expression, and he still chose to speak to those that he did have limited interaction with, and he chose to write. And we have the New Testament here now. And he took that situation that he was given, and he used it to the best of his ability. Paul was able to do these remarkable things. How? Well, I think there's lots of different reasons we could describe that. I just want to offer us one quick thought as we close. And band, you could come back on up here. We're gonna sing one song after this. But if we go back to Acts 25, I just want to read a couple verses here. This is Festus's description to Agrippa of Paul's case. What does he highlight here? Well, it says, this is Festus talking to Agrippa. He says, "When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who is dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive." And I think the thing that stood out to Festus was that Paul kept saying that Jesus was alive. He's alive. And he was just, this consumed him, the living God. Jesus was still alive, and therefore he could walk into this situation unwaveringly so, without fear, and he could speak what he needed to speak because he knew Jesus was alive, and he could pour his life out because Jesus showed that life was still possible even after death.